A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's written in with one of those prompts that makes me want to go check my own purchase history and count how many times I've been had. His question, and it's a long one, is about the Amazon brand, the pop-up manufacturer that exists mainly to capture keyword search demand. He draws a line between that and two other categories. Quality versus brands, the ones with a track record and a reputation. And budget brands, which he says nobody should dismiss. They have a real role in any economy. The misleading thing about the Amazon brand is that it enters a niche with no commitment to either excellence or value. It's a pure commercial placeholder. Veteran Amazon users develop heuristics to spot them, but there's no clean filter Amazon exposes. No way to say, show me everything except these. And Daniel's point is that the reason is political. Most of these brands come from China, so a filter would read as anti-China, anti-Asia. But he rejects that framing. Plenty of good brands come from China. This isn't about geography. It's about sincerity versus fake brands that pop up to score easy traffic. His core question is whether marketplaces like Amazon can ever rid themselves of this kind of actor, or whether the scale itself creates them as a byproduct. So, we need a taxonomy before we can ask if the system can fix itself.
The taxonomy is where I want to start, because the distinction Daniel's drawing is sharper than most people make it. There are three tiers. Quality-first brands invest in research and development. They build a reputation over years. They have a track record you can check. Budget brands compete on price, and they deliver honest value for that price. You know what you're getting. The Amazon brand is neither. The product is a means to a search ranking end. The brand isn't a promise to a customer, it's a vehicle for search optimization.
The listing is the product.
The physical object is almost incidental. And that's the thing that makes it hard to spot, because these aren't necessarily cheap. A budget brand prices low, and you understand why. An Amazon brand often prices mid-range, right in that zone where you think, oh, this must be decent, it's not the cheapest option. They're using price as a quality signal without having the quality to back it.
So we've got this three-tier system, quality first, budget, and the parasite class. The question is how the parasite class actually works under the hood. And I think the mechanism starts with the flywheel. When search ranking is your primary acquisition channel, the rational play is to optimize for the ranking algorithm, not the product.
It inverts the entire logic of brand building. Traditional brand building says, make something good, earn a reputation, and sales follow. The Amazon brand says, find the demand that already exists, engineer a listing that captures it, and the product just has to be good enough to not trigger returns. You're not creating demand, you're harvesting it.
Walk me through the life cycle. I've seen these brands, but I've never thought about the actual sequence.
It starts with keyword research. You're looking for a search term with high purchase intent and thin competition. Something specific. Not just headphones, but something like, I don't know, silicone baking mat with measurements. You find a generic product from a manufacturer, usually in Shenzhen or Yiwu, and you create a brand name that sounds trustworthy, something that sounds like it's been around for 30 years but was registered last Tuesday.
The random word combinations, VOKTR, Bamsley, names that sound like a Danish furniture company but are actually two syllables from a name generator.
Then you optimize the listing. Keyword stuff titles, review, harvesting strategies, the whole apparatus. And here's the thing. A single factory in Shenzhen can produce the same generic gadget for dozens of these brands. Different packaging, different listing copy, same product. The factory doesn't care about the brand, and the brand doesn't care about the factory. They're both just components in a search arbitrage play.
And the customer's trust is the raw material being mined.
That's the part that bothers me. A budget brand is honest about what it is. You pay $12 for a garlic press, you get a $12 garlic press. The Amazon brand charges $28 for the same garlic press because $28 is the price point where you think, this is probably a step up. They're occupying a deceptive middle, neither excellent nor a genuine value play. They present as a legitimate alternative while being neither.
So, how do veteran users actually spot them? Because Daniel mentioned heuristics, and I've got mine, but they're labor-intensive.
The brand name is the first tell. Random word combinations, or worse, names that are almost a real brand, but with one letter changed. Then there's the Scattergun product range, a brand selling dog toys and phone chargers and camping stoves. A real company that makes dog toys doesn't suddenly pivot to USB cables. The listing photos look like renders, not photographs. And the review patterns cluster in bursts. 50 reviews in a week, then nothing for 3 months.
I've noticed the review thing. It's like watching a heartbeat on a monitor. Flatline, flatline, spike, flatline.
But here's the problem with heuristics. They're unreliable, they take time, and the operators adapt. The moment a tell becomes widely known, they change it. The information asymmetry is built into the system. Amazon has the data to identify these actors instantly. The consumer has to develop pattern recognition skills like they're birdwatching.
Birdwatching for fraud.
And the thing is, even when you spot one, it doesn't matter. You report it, Amazon removes it, and three more pop up. The life cycle is designed for this, scale or abandon. If the listing works, you ride it until the reviews catch up with reality. If it doesn't, you abandon the brand and start fresh with a new name. The brand is disposable by design.
So we've seen how an individual operator games the system. The uncomfortable question is whether Amazon is an unwitting accomplice or a willing one, and I think the answer is that it's structural. Amazon's business model depends on the long tail of third-party sellers. Over 60% of Amazon's sales come from third-party sellers, and a huge portion of those are Chinese manufacturers. The platform's revenue is agnostic to whether the seller is sincere. Amazon takes its cut either way.
The transaction fee doesn't care about your intentions. And that's the thing. Amazon profits from these actors exactly as much as it profits from a quality-first brand. Actually, possibly more, because the Amazon brand operators are often heavy users of Amazon's advertising products. They're paying for sponsored placements, they're buying ads. They're not just tolerated, they're monetized.
So when Daniel asks why there's no filter for non-Amazon brands, the answer starts with the fact that the filter would be an admission. It'd be Amazon saying, our incentive structure produces bad actors, and here's a tool to avoid them.
And then there's the political layer. If you build that filter, the majority of what it catches is going to be Chinese sellers. That's just the reality of the manufacturing ecosystem. China makes the generic products, so Chinese sellers are the ones who can execute this strategy cheapest and fastest. A filter would be perceived and weaponized as anti-China.
And Amazon is in an impossible position on this. They're caught in the crossfire of US-China trade tensions already. Any feature that disproportionately affects Chinese sellers becomes a geopolitical statement. You'd have hearings about it. You'd have retaliation threats. You'd have the Chinese state media calling it economic discrimination.
But Daniel's point is sharper than that, and I think he's right. The rhetoric that ties this problem to China is a trap. It's a nationalist narrative that obscures the actual structural issue. Plenty of excellent brands come from China. Anker is the obvious example. Chinese company built a genuine reputation through quality investment now commands premium placement. Origin isn't the issue. Sincerity is.
Anker's actually the perfect counterexample because they started in exactly the same ecosystem. They were selling laptop batteries and chargers, commodity products, but they made a different decision. They invested in quality control. They built a support infrastructure. They took returns seriously. They decided to be a real brand. Same starting point, different intent.
And that's what makes the nationalist framing so useless. It collapses a distinction that actually matters. The difference between Anker and a pop-up brand is a geography. It's whether anyone at the company cares if the product works next year. Whether there's a warranty that means something. Whether the brand would survive a bad product cycle.
The Amazon brand wouldn't survive a bad product cycle. It's not designed to. It's designed to extract value from search infrastructure and move on.
So we've got two layers to why the filter doesn't exist. The political layer, which is real but somewhat superficial. And the structural layer, which is that Amazon's business model is built on the long tail. over 60% of sales from third-party sellers. You can't build a filter that excludes a huge portion of your seller base without admitting that your platform has a quality problem.
And the filter itself would be hard to design. What's the criterion? Country of origin? That's the political minefield. Brand age? The operators would just age their brands, like domain squatters. Review velocity? They'd slow down the review harvesting. Any mechanical filter creates a new optimization target.
That's the arms race problem. Amazon's brand registry and trademark requirements were supposed to help. They raised the barrier slightly, but they're reactive measures. They don't change the underlying incentive structure. The moment you make listing harder, the operators get better at listing. The moment you require trademarks, they register trademarks. It's a cat and mouse game where the mouse has infinite resources and no reputation to protect.
So let's talk about the knock-on effect. The degradation of search is a trust signal. When Amazon brands proliferate, the search results page becomes a minefield. Every listing is suspect, and the cost of verification shifts to the consumer.
This is the adverse selection spiral. As genuine brands get drowned out, they either leave the platform or they're forced to compete on the same search optimization terms, which further erodes the signal. It's a race to the bottom, and the bottom is a search page where nothing can be trusted at face value.
I've watched myself go through this. I used to trust the search results. Now I cross-reference everything. I check the seller's other products. I read the one-star reviews first. I look for the tells. I've become a forensic accountant just to buy a vegetable peeler.
And that's the hidden cost, the labor of verification. Amazon offloads the work of distinguishing real brands from fake ones onto the consumer. You're doing quality control for them for free, and the only tool they give you is your own skepticism.
The comparison to Etsy or eBay is useful here. Different incentive structures, different problems. Etsy has curation and community, so the bad actors live different. eBay has a feedback system that's been around for decades, but they all face analogous problems. The issue is platform design, not geography.
Etsy's problem was dropshippers pretending to be handmade. Same structure, different costume. Someone finds demand for handmade-looking jewelry, sources it from a factory, and presents it as artisanal. The platform's incentive structure rewards the deception, so the deception happens.
Is this a bug or a feature? And I think the honest answer is that Amazon brands aren't an accident. They're the predictable output of a system that rewards search optimization over product quality. Scale creates the problem, because scale means the search surface area is enormous. The barrier to entry is low, and Amazon's incentives are agnostic to seller quality.
The marketplace doesn't just tolerate these actors, it profits from them equally, sometimes more because they buy ads. So the question of whether Amazon could rid itself of them is almost the wrong question. The right question is whether Amazon would want to, and the answer is complicated.
Because on one hand, the Amazon brand degrades the trust that makes the marketplace valuable in the first place. Long term, that's corrosive. If consumers stop trusting search results, they go elsewhere. But short term, these sellers generate revenue. They fill the long tail. They make the marketplace look comprehensive.
The long tail is the thing. Amazon's promise is that you can find anything. That promise requires an enormous number of sellers. The quality of those sellers is secondary to their existence. A marketplace that curated heavily would be smaller, and smaller isn't the Amazon model.
Is there hope? I think the honest answer is that as long as search ranking is the primary discovery mechanism, and Amazon takes a cut regardless of seller quality, the incentive to game the system will persist. The problem isn't about to be fixed. It's a structural feature of a marketplace that monetizes attention rather than curation.
The counterforces exist. Brand registry, trademark requirements, gating on certain categories. But they're reactive and incomplete. They raise the barrier slightly. They don't change the underlying economics.
Let me ask you something. If the factory owner in Shenzhen can produce the same product for 50 different brands, what stops that factory owner from becoming a genuine brand themselves? They have the manufacturing capability. They have the quality control infrastructure. What's missing?
Intent and incentive. The factory owner who makes garbage for other people's brands is responding to the same incentive structure as everyone else. The marketplace rewards listing optimization over product quality, so they optimize listings. If the marketplace rewarded product quality, they'd optimize products. The capability is there.
That's the thing I keep coming back to. The capability exists. China's manufacturing ecosystem isn't the problem. It's the incentive structure that determines whether that capability produces anchor or produces 100 disposable brands.
That's why I think Daniel's framing is so useful. By separating the China question from the sincerity question, he gets at the actual mechanism. The problem isn't where the product comes from. The problem is whether anyone involved is trying to build something that lasts.
We've got this structural analysis. The system produces these actors. The platform profits from them. The consumer pays the verification cost. And the political rhetoric obscures all of it.
The question Daniel asked, whether there's hope for marketplaces to rid themselves of this, I think the answer is that the problem doesn't get solved. It gets managed. The arms race continues. The heuristics evolve. The filters get better, and the operators get better at evading them.
I sold MP3 players on Amazon for about 2 years. Late 2000s. Sourced them from a factory in Guangzhou, put my own brand name on them, Connect. I thought it sounded trustworthy.
Connect.
I was one of these operators. I didn't think of myself as a scammer. I thought of myself as an arbitrageur. The factory made the product, the marketplace provided the demand, and the brand was just the connective tissue. I optimized the listing, I rode the search rankings for cheap MP3 player, and I made money until the market collapsed. The thing is, I got out because I couldn't stomach the race to the bottom. My competitors were better at it than me. They'd cut corners I wouldn't cut, and they'd still get the 4.5 stars because they'd optimized the review pipeline. I bought one of their products once, just to see. It was terrible. Stopped working after 6 weeks. But the reviews were glowing because they'd figured out how to harvest them.
You were a rational actor in a system that rewarded exactly what you were doing.
That's what I'm saying. I wasn't a villain. I was playing the game as it was designed. The search algorithm rewarded listing quality over product quality. Everyone knew it. The people who won were the ones who were best at listing quality. The product was almost irrelevant.
The factory in Guangzhou, what happened to them?
That's the part that complicates the story. I still talk to the guy who ran the factory. Went by the name of Mr. Chen. A few years after I got out, he started his own brand. Camping gear. Tents, stoves, that kind of thing. And it's actually decent quality. He told me he got tired of making garbage for other people's brands. Decided to make his own. The same factory, the same workers, the same equipment. But now, he's building something real.
The same manufacturing ecosystem that produces the Amazon brands can also produce genuine ones. The difference isn't capability, it's intent.
That's the open question. If Mr. Chen can become a genuine brand, and the operator who sourced from him can be a parasite, then the line isn't geography, and it isn't even manufacturing capability. It's the incentive structure of the platform. Can any marketplace at Amazon scale design incentives that reward sincerity?
Or is the scale itself the problem? Maybe at a certain size, the search surface area becomes too large to curate, and the only viable strategy is algorithmic ranking. An algorithmic ranking is always gameable.
I still have a box of KO1-necked MP3 players in my flat. About 40 of them. I keep meaning to throw them out, but I can't bring myself to do it. Feels like admitting something.
The thing about Mr. Chen is that he didn't change his manufacturing process. He changed his time horizon. He decided to build something that would still exist in 5 years, and that decision was available to him the whole time. The platform didn't make it impossible, it just didn't reward it.
That's the uncomfortable conclusion. The platform doesn't make sincerity impossible, it just makes it irrational. The rational play is the pop-up brand. The sincere play is the sucker's game. Unless you have the resources to survive long enough to build a reputation.
Anchor had those resources. Mr. Chen had the factory infrastructure. The operator with a laptop and a keyword research tool has neither. So they play the game that's available to them.
The question Daniel asked was whether there's hope for marketplaces to rid themselves of this. And I think the answer is that the problem is structural. And structural problems don't get solved. They get managed. The arms race continues.
The thing to watch is whether Amazon's increasing use of AI in search and recommendation changes the game. If the algorithms get better at detecting listing quality versus product quality, the economics of the Amazon brand shift. But I'm skeptical. The operators have AI too.
The problem migrates. If Amazon gets better at filtering, the operators move to the next platform with scale. Walmart's marketplace, TikTok shop, whatever comes next, the incentive structure follows the traffic.
The answer to Daniel's question is that the scale creates them as a byproduct. It's not a bug. It's the exhaust of a system that monetizes attention. And the only real defense is the consumer's own skepticism, which is exhausting and unfair, but it's what we've got.
The structural problem doesn't get solved. It gets managed, and the management is imperfect, and the cost lands on the consumer. But at least now we understand why the search results look the way they do.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, as always.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.